Accession number 30639, Mr. Alan Davis, reel 12.
The handle just would not move, so I had to do a whole circuit and then land again and then taxi back to the hard standing, which wasn't very far off the runway, and ask a fitter to show me how to, you know. I said, this bloody handle's stuck, it won't move the canopy forward. He said, oh, well, you've got to push it in or pull it out or something, as well as turn it. And I sat in the cockpit, of course, and the only thing I hadn't done, so to speak, hadn't rehearsed, was closing the canopy hood. So I did my first solo with the canopy open and the roaring wind and howling gale that you have to sit in to do that. Anyway, the actual circuit and the first solo was a success. So I had the extra joy of doing a second takeoff, still in the first, on the first solo, and that then learned how to close the canopy, so all was well.
Now, having done the flying, of the Spitfire 14 with 6102 Kievo, now there's also the photographic reconnaissance army cooperation side. Now, take me through that training, both in the air and on the ground. I don't know which comes first, so whichever order. You've mentioned photography twice, perhaps.
Yes. Well, going back to the basis that we were supposed to know how to fly, this operational training unit was the learning how to do something in the aeroplane, which is what the RAF required. Photography, artillery reconnaissance, and that sort of thing that the army would require aerial observation for. And this, of course, is why I found my time at Kievel was probably the most interesting time of my flying career, because it was infinitely more interesting than the squadron, because the squadron didn't have an operational capacity anymore. There was nothing worth, you know, it wasn't necessary to go and photograph anything. You'd done it in exercise at OTU, and the squadron was running down, and you know, it didn't happen. So the OTU was quite the most interesting part of my flying training. Now the photography, we had a vertical camera and we had an oblique camera. They are just what they said that they say they are. You had to fly exactly over, let's say, a length of road, taking photographs. You just had a switch and you switched it on, and the plane or the camera automatically took pictures after every so many seconds. So you had to fly at, let's say, I can't remember the speed, 200 and something, 250 miles an hour, let's say 250 knots, and keep the speed exact, as you could, so that these photographs automatically were taken, and you got a correct, as they call it, line overlap, and each photograph just slightly overlapped the photograph previously taken. And the same thing applied to the one on the oblique one. Now the oblique one, again, it is easier to look out of the left hand side of a fighter aircraft than the right hand side, because the throttle is that side, and it so happened that the mark on the wing, you lined up the oblique for the oblique photograph, and if it passed under this little white mark on the wing, you knew you were lined up. But again, the plane had to be flown accurately, not banking or side slipping or whatever, otherwise the photographs were not in correct sequence. So we were sent off on photography exercises, and you would have a map, like this one, for example. I don't know whether this particular one has got it. No, it hasn't. You'd have a map of the correct scale, and the photography section would say, all right, I want a photograph from there, and they make a circle around a village or a town, and then draw a crayon mark about 4 or 5 inches on the map, and then another circle. They say, I want a photograph of that road, which happened to be, let's say, quite a straight patch of road somewhere in Wiltshire. And so you had to go and find the spot and get lined up with the map and the road and work out how the wind was likely to affect you. And you had a little thing which we used to call a computer strapped to your knee. And it was a circular graph affair, and it was really giving it a highfalutin name for a very, very amateurish type of instrument. But it had a dial which revolved, and so you could plot your course to steer. Let's say, supposing the road was like this in front of me now, running completely east to west. You would set the on the computer, strapped to your knee, a 270 or a 090 mark on the revolving pad with a pencil, which you'd erase by licking your finger and rubbing it, and then you'd plot what the forecast wind was, and then work out the course you had to steer to achieve that track, just like you'd. One did many, many, many years later when you're learning to sail. So exactly the same principle. What you recorded in one of these previous recordings, triangle of velocities, didn't you give it? You had.
I believe they call it, the bombers call it that.
I believe they did call it that, yes. I'm absolutely right. Anyway, you had to do that in the air. So anyone got quite good at it. And when you flew that course, and you just hoped that you were you knew you started in the right place, and you hoped you finished up in the right place. So you did your vertical one, so you couldn't see what you were actually photographing at all. Well, with the oblique, it was just going past your front, your leading edge of your wing, and so you knew exactly if you'd got that right. So obliques were, I suppose, marginally easier to do.
Were they taken at a lower altitude?
Well, they were taken at about, as I remember, excuse me, about 6,000 or 8,000 feet, I think. That was the sort of altitude that we were flying at. So it was a fairly safe altitude, but we were taught to do it at that height because that is supposedly the extreme range of light anti-aircraft. Is 8,000 feet, and the powerful stuff doesn't start till 8,000 feet. So theoretically, you were on a fairly safe height operationally, and then that's what we were taught to do. Now it's difficult enough to do it at operational training unit to get it right, but imagine having to do it when you're being pooped at by anti-aircraft guns from down below. Who, if this stretch of territory that you were, enemy territory that you were trying to photograph was an important one, then the anti-aircraft defence would be colossal. So that taking a photograph like this operationally would have been, and certainly was, extremely difficult. And people who did it lived to get the aeroplane back and the photographs back did a wonderful job.
They didn't use, well, some of them did, but you didn't train on cine film reconnaissance. You know, it was just oblique and yes, straight down. Yes, you didn't yes, use the yes, cinema, no, cine film.
No. So that was all we were trained to do.
And were you at all trained in photographic interpretation, i.e. no. what happens when no. you get these photographs? Was that a completely separate discipline?
Well, we may have been shown what the photographs what they could read into the photographs, but that was just a politeness, if you like, to show the end product of what we were trying to do. But we were not trained in interpretation at all. We just photographed what we were told to photograph, or I learned from my friends who flew operationally, if they spotted something that they thought was important, like a column of troops or vehicles or something on a road, they would take a photograph of it, just to identify where it was, just so that it benefited the army interpretation people when they got back to base. But that was photography. We also did artillery reconnaissance. Again, it must have been absolutely colossal to do it in action and get it right. But we were taught how to do it, and we liaised with the army in
now, is this reconnaissance or observation? In other words, were you controlling the guns?
Yes,
or were you just doing photographs for the guns?
Actually controlling the guns. We used to do it with the troops from Lark Hill, the artillery range on Salisbury Plain. And we were taught by the use of a sand table by a major RA who was a a strange joker. He was a major and therefore thought himself quite an authority, which he probably was, on artillery. And
This is a school of artillery, yeah?
Well, either at the School of Artillery or back at the Trowbridge, at Keble, because he had a sand table, and it must have been about as square as this table here is long, so it would be about 6 or 8 feet square, and it was covered with green hessian and imitation trees and buildings and things, and you would stand at one side of the table, and he had a smoke gadget, and you'd have a target indicated with a little label, probably target, and you would assume that you were in an aeroplane, and he would assume that the artillery was poofing off its guns, and a little puffs of smoke would appear out of this sand table, and he used to plan his puffs of smoke up the artillery explosions so that he leads you into a pattern of issuing the instructions. So you would be in the air and you'd report that you were ready. I've forgotten the actual drill and the wording of it, but it was, you know, all carefully prescribed. You had to use the correct procedure. And you'd call out for a sighting shot, and you knew the target was somewhere there, and so the guns would poop off a shell, and you had to spot where it landed, and you got a little puff of smoke. And if you can imagine doing this from, again, I think around probably 8,000 feet, in a high-speed aeroplane, with no help, nobody else there but you, if it was murky, and the weather was, you know, murky, and you didn't have a very clear horizon, you had a hell of a job to realise whether you were flying north, south, east or west. But you knew the guns were down here somewhere, and you knew the target was there, and you asked for a sighting shot, and they would poop off in Lark Hill or on the sand table, the same procedure, and you'd see this little puff of smoke. Well, if you didn't happen to be looking in the right direction, you didn't see this bloody puff of smoke anyway. So you had to call for a second shot, and so on, and until the army got fed up with playing that game, but that never happened. Eventually you'd see one of these shots. So you would say either left or right, or up or down, up 1,000, and there'd be an extra 1,000 yards, so the artillery would elevate their guns and poop the next shell 1,000 yards ahead, or 500, or whatever it was. And then they'd start getting it lined up, and then you drop it back to what did I say, up or down 500, and so you'd look to see where this next puff of smoke appeared. And as I say, doing it in the air was really quite difficult.
Did they teach you the bracketing system that the artillery used?
Yes.
Do you remember it?
Well, just that. If you you were 500 yards to the left, and you did 500 yards to the right, and if it you know, was beyond the target, then you had bracketed it, and then you halved the distances, and so you got the next shells coming in towards more towards the target. This frequently used to happen, and apparently 225 Squadron did this quite a lot, both with the Army and the Navy, which is why all fighter reconnaissance pilots were officers, because either the Army or the Navy, or probably both of them, did not like taking instructions from NCO pilots. So traditionally all the pilots in the fighter reconnaissance squadron were officers, which was again an advantage, because we all lived in the same mess. If you got some pilots living in an officer mess and some pilots living in a sergeant's mess, you've got an immediate division of them and us, you know, division, and I don't think that was particularly good. Anyway, we didn't have to that particular bother, because all of us were commissioned. And so we learnt photo reconnaissance.
Now, what do you remember about the flights correcting artillery on Lark Hill ranges? I mean, it is difficult. I mean, how did you do at that? I'm not talking about the sand table now, I'm talking about when you actually did a practice flight.
It was reasonably satisfactory. I can't ever say that you landed a shell absolutely on target, but you got jolly close to it, because you know even the guns had slight bothers. You know, presumably the wind did affect a lobbed shell. Anyway, this major chap was quite a good instructor, and I thoroughly enjoyed the comparatively few jaunts we had to over to Lark Hill and the real artillery reconnaissance with real live guns pooping off real live rounds, well, smoke rounds anyway. So that was quite fun. So we did fighter reconnaissance, artillery reconnaissance, and the other things they did was to send you give you a map reference before you took off. And you had to identify from the air what the map reference was. So, for example, they would know that there was a red Dutch barn in the corner of a field somewhere in Wiltshire. And they would give you the map reference, and you had to come back and tell them what it was, what the map reference referred to. A red barn in the corner of a field, for example. Or it might be a church steeple, or it might be a windmill, but something that was quite significant to observe. And they'd do you a similar thing. They would tell you, for example, that the southeast of a village just outside Swindon, for example, there is a windmill in the corner of a field. Now go and find it, and radio back what the map reference is. So week one became very very accurate in one's map reading and interpretation of what you were looking at and dealing with map references, all in preparation of doing this real thing with the Army, or it turned out with 225 with the Navy as well. So if you did with that, we did a certain amount of air-to-ground firing on a range.
Now tell me about that, because you haven't trained at all in combat.
No.
And I noticed that several pilots don't seem to have done much training in combat. No. Tell me about air-to-ground firing then.
Well, I don't remember doing any air-to-air firing at Kievel. I suppose we must have done, because they had drogue chaps who flew an aeroplane that towed a drogue at about 500 or 600 yards behind them. They had a chap in the aircraft with them who worked the winch for the drogue, and you just fired at the drogue, and you apparently the bullets were covered in some sort of coloured paint, so that they could tell how many times you had hit the drogue by the colour of the paint around the holes. So we did a certain amount of air-to-air firing, which I can't remember much about, so it wasn't presumably very significant.
What about at the ground?
But we did some air-to-ground firing when we had some ground targets stuck out in the middle of the marshes, not far from Bristol, somewhere between Bristol and I don't know, somewhere in the southwest of Bristol anyway, on the marshes beside the Severn. And there was an officer and I don't know how many men who manned that unit. And what the hell they did the rest of the day, I don't know, but they can't have been very busy. Anyway, they used to report on the radio whether the ranges were clear and ready for use, so that it was, you know, try to eliminate accidents and danger and so on. And I've forgotten what the targets were, whether they were square or oblong or circular. I just don't remember. But I know we used to go and poop off these guns, COCs and 0.5s, I suppose they were, fixing the wings. And again, we must have had either coloured bullets or the score was tallied up after each plane flew. And
had you been taught how to aim and things like deflection shooting?
Oh yes.
When did you learn that?
Well, we were taught that in theory at ground school, you know, forever. You know, starting at Heaton Park. But the only time we were able to practice that was at our clay pigeon shooting, which we didn't have very much of after Falcon Field in Arizona. That was the last time I remember doing any clay pigeon shooting. But that's where you learnt the art, if you like to call it an art, of deflection. Because we had these socking great gun sights mounted in the front of the cockpit for the air-to-air firing, and just a simple gun sight, you know, straight ahead gun sight for the air-to-ground firing. But we didn't do very much of it because the war was over by then, as you observed earlier on. So that was fairly limited, but the artillery and the photographic reconnaissance was very much in evidence still.
Did they teach you, I mean, they used to apparently fly in pairs with one weaving behind the other one.
Mm-hmm.
Were you taught that at Keble?
Yes, we were.
Can you explain the system? Because
we nearly always flew in pairs, even at OTU. And we certainly always flew in pairs on the squadron. But that was the thing. You had a number one and a number two, and the number one was the person who was briefed as to what to do, and the number two, all the number two did was a bit of navigation, in as much as he needed to know where he was and how to get back to base, and to guard the tail of the number one.
So how did they do that? Because there's this weaving, yes, that everyone seems to talk about.
Yes, well, they weave in as much as you don't fly side by side. You drop behind and you look for any enemy aircraft likely to approach anywhere near the number one, and defend his tail. That's what it amounted to. So you're looking for an intruder creeping up on the number one, either from behind or underneath or whatever, and it is your duty to report to the number one any possible danger, and the number one then decides whether to push off and forget all about it, or to stick at it and put up the consequences, and in which case it would be the number two's job to scare or warn or fight the opposing aircraft, the attacking aircraft. But in the squadron, in the latter part of the war, this was almost a formality, because there was so little enemy activity. They were so short of fuel, they could hardly defend themselves from the air at all. But so it was a question really of the number two looking after the number one and making sure that if he did get shot down, for example, to mark...
By ground fire.
To mark where he landed, and so that any rescue operation could be mounted if it were not in behind enemy lines. That's the sort of duties of a weaver.
Did you do any combat training at all?
No, hardly. Well, hardly any.
What did you do? What level of combat? Because, I mean, it's quite noticeable that although you're flying these high-performance fighters, you are not fighter pilots. You are reconnaissance pilots.
Yeah. 90-something percent reconnaissance, yes, other than the actual fighter. Periodically, even back in Arizona, we used to do cine camera firing at each other from Falcon Field in Arizona. I don't remember doing any of that at the advanced flying units, but I do remember that at operational training unit, one of the instructors would set off after you had taken off and bounce you. That was the expression they used. While you were doing all this reconnaissance and so on, they would try and get behind you and creep up on you and make you conscious of the fact that you have to watch your tail, as well as find these red coloured Dutch barn in the corner of a field. So you've got an awful lot to do whilst you're flying around. So it's important that the flying becomes almost a natural reaction rather than a conscious effort. And you can put up 90% of your thinking ability into what you're trying to do rather than fly the aeroplane. So yes, they used to bounce us, but they only used to creep up behind you and go on the radio and say, you weren't looking, were you? Ha ha ha. And see if they could do that several times while you were in the air. But that was the limit of the fighter part of, as far as I was concerned, at OTU.
Now, any other training or any other subjects or topics that you covered there?
I can only think of the fact that we were sent on escaping exercises.
Now, tell me about that.
Well, they could be, or they were supposed to be more exciting than they were.
Is this the escape and evasion exercise?
Yes. They would take you all off in a 3-ton truck, and you weren't supposed to have your hats. You're supposed to leave hats. So the only identification that you were an escapee was that you didn't have a hat. And they would just dump you somewhere in the country and you didn't really know where, and you had to find your way back, which was not very exciting, usually, because...
We all dumped together, or
in pairs, and sometimes separately, but just offloaded.
How far?
Oh, 5 or 6 miles, that sort of distance. Walkable back, if you had to. I think most of us used to hitchhike back when we got fed up with humping through the roads. It was just a pretty dull sort of exercise.
And was there anyone looking for you?
Well, they used to say there were, and whether there were was really, I just don't know. I never saw anybody.
So they were pretty unrealistic from the sound.
Pretty unrealistic, because the need for realism had disappeared. There really wasn't any need for intensive training on that. Whether that was more intensive before the end of the war, I really wouldn't know. I've never heard of anybody having any bother with that sort of thing.